Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Alan Butler, who is the author, along with Janet Walzer, of American Nation of the Goddess, The Venus Families and the Founding of the United States. This book is relating back to Templar history, the history of the Freemasons, and the role that the organizations that have traditionally opposed the Catholic Church have played in the founding of the United States, and even earlier trips by the Templars to the United States and the new continent before Christopher Columbus ever sailed. It's a wonderful historical book and helps us understand some of the founding principles that the nation was founded on. And I think especially these days we need to be reminded of these principles because we're deviating from them somewhat. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining us. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from the United Kingdom, from the north of England.
Well, great, great. Well, would you give the listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Yeah. All my life I've been interested in ancient history, particularly to do with structures such as Stonehenge, Avebury, places like that, both in Britain and in France. And eventually I found myself being led towards medieval history. I became very fascinated by all the things that were happening in a region called Champagne in the 11th, 12th century. And one of those things was the creation of the Knights Templar. Together with other authors and on my own, I've written now over 20 books, many of which were related to that period of history. I got to know Scott Walzer, who's Janet's husband, through television programs I did with him, and that got me in touch with Janet, and I discovered that Janet was a fantastic researcher and a person with tremendous intuition, and we started to talk, and eventually we decided we had enough to write a book, and that's how this one came about.
Well, let's start a little bit talking about the Templars and why Friday the 13th is an unlucky day. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah. On Friday the 13th, 1307, the French king, who was called Philip IV, decided to make a move against the Templars. The Templars were very rich by this time. They were great traders as well as being great fighters. They had pots and pots of money, and they used to lend money to all the crowned heads of Europe, and France was one of them. And I guess that Philip IV thought, amongst other things, that if he could get rid of the Knights Templars, then he could write off the debt that he owed them. But there was a whole load of political circumstances that led up to this happening. He had, via his son, gained control of the region of Champagne, which was where the Templars had started. He thought they were colossally rich, and indeed they were, but he thought that they would keep all their money in a few specific places, which they didn't. And so he made this attack on the Templars, and with a tame pope in Rome that allowed him to do so. But he found that there were very few Templars actually in France, and he also discovered that there was no gold whatsoever. So it seems almost certain that the Templars knew very well what was going to happen, and they'd moved anything of any value before it could happen. And then ultimately, the rest of the crowned heads of Europe, most of them, moved against the Templars, and they then became an illegal organization.
And eventually secret society, morphing into Freemasons and other similarly based secret societies. Before we go on, though, I'd like you to tell the audience a little bit about how the Templars came up with some revolutionary ideas about banking, and how that was important in medieval times, especially for merchants that were traveling in Europe and between Europe and the Middle East.
Yeah, they became the world's first checkbook bankers in a way. Because they had established headquarters in most of the major towns and cities of Europe, they established a system whereby, supposing a merchant wanted to go from London to Rome, then he would put his money into the Templar headquarters in London. They would give him a coded promissory note, which he could take with him to Rome, and he would not be attacked because he wouldn't have anything worth stealing. When he got to Rome, then the promissory note would be given into the headquarters there, and they would give him the gold, less the commission that they charged. And they charged the commission by the exchange rate between different countries' coins, and so that got them a big profit, but they weren't breaking the law, because in those days it was called usury, and it was illegal to charge interest on loans that were given. But in addition to actually giving this service to merchants all over Europe, they then started to take a lot of money and lend it to people. So they became bankers in that sense as well.
And it's important to note that the Knights Templar, the people that belonged to that organization, also had a mission for protecting pilgrims that were going to the Holy Land. So they had a dual role in that they were, they basically took vows of poverty. So none of the Knights Templars were independently wealthy. All the wealth belonged to the organization, but then they were very much involved in protecting travelers to the Holy Land. That was their, I guess, the face of their organization.
Yeah, I mean, that really was the face, but it was a bit of a misnomer. Only a handful of original Templar Knights went to Jerusalem, and there's no evidence whatsoever that they ever did anything to protect any pilgrims who were travelling backwards and forwards. By that time, the First Crusade had been fought, and it was fairly safe for Christian pilgrims to go to Jerusalem. But that was the excuse that was given for their formation. In fact, they went to Jerusalem and more or less disappeared for a number of years before they came back to Champagne. And in the city of Troyes, there was a big meeting at which the Pope was present, and they were then made an official order. But I think it's something of a smokescreen. They were there to do something that they wanted to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the concept of courtly love that came out of Champagne and how the Catholic Church opposed it and why it was important to the Knights Templar.
Courtly love was something that developed around the same time as the Templars were forming. It was a very strange concept. If you were, for example, a leading knight in a particular country, you might set your sights on a princess or a queen, someone who was way, way above your station, and someone who might already be married. You became then the adoring person, the protector of that individual. So courtly love didn't necessarily lead to relationships. Sometimes it did, but most times it didn't. But the thing about courtly love was it came amidst a new version of story called the Romance, which was starting to sweep across Europe, but which seems to have started out in the city of Troyes in Champagne. And within these stories, there was all this courtly love. But the stories also were very much associated with earlier legends, like the legend of King Arthur and the legend of the Holy Grail. And so courtly love itself was important, but it was important as part of something which came into being at the same time as the Knights Templars did. And it really elevated mysticism. The one thing that the Templars really wanted, alongside the rulers of Champagne, was for nobody to know exactly what they were doing or why they were doing it. And all this romance and all this mysticism played very much into their hands in that respect. And it also gained them a lot of respect at first from ordinary people. They were, in fact, monks. So you're right in saying that they had no money of their own. Some of them were landed gentry. Some of them were dukes. But when they took the promise to be Templars, then all of that went out the window, and they lived as monks.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Holy Grail? The Holy Grail is a symbol, obviously, but it has many different meanings. And let's talk a little bit about that and how it may relate to the Templars' greatest secret, which probably gave them their greatest power, that the Catholic Church did not want to be revealed.
Yeah, the Holy Grail was different things to different people. When the stories of the Holy Grail first started to develop in Champagne, at almost exactly the same time as the Templars were founded, it came in a story by a man in Troyes, in Champagne, called Chrétien de Troyes. Now, Chrétien wrote this story about Percival, who was a hero from legend and myth. And in the story, Percival is having a meal with some people he's met at a magical castle. And something is brought into the meal, which is called the Grail. But Percival didn't know what it was, and Chrétien cannot tell us what it was. Some people think it was the cup that Jesus drank from at the Last Supper. Other people think it might be related to a bloodline, in fact, the bloodline of Jesus, and that the Grail really represents the latest representative of that bloodline. I think also I have published in my own books about the Grail that it probably was an idea, and it probably was to do with a group of people that Janet and I have called the Venus families. We call them the Venus families because they've always been fanatically interested for all sorts of reasons in the planet Venus. But these people may have held on to this idea of the bloodline of the Holy Grail, and probably still are doing so. But the Holy Grail has many different faces, though I think the bloodline one is probably the most likely.
Yeah, the common one amongst, like when you learn about it in school, is that it is the elixir of everlasting life. You know, if you drink from it, then you don't die. But really, if you think about it, if if you are initiated into these spiritual mysteries and you get to the top of them, you're able to master everything, then you do, according to the mysteries, inhabit your light body consciously, so you never die. Even if you drop the physical body, you maintain that memory all the way through. So I think that might be the connection.
Oh, I think that's a very good way of putting it, because obviously if you become the enlightened one and you understand, because a lot of this goes back to ancient forms of religion, which were called mysteries. And in the mysteries, you had to go through a whole series of events, very similar to the rituals in modern Freemasonry. And by so doing, you would take on the mantle of an immortal. So yes, it might be suggested by anyone who didn't really know that if you drank out of the Grail, assuming the Grail was a cup, that you would have immortality. But on the other hand, if you understood what the Grail was, what it really represented and what it stood for, then it probably would, as you suggested, buy you a kind of immortality.
Yeah, one of my good friends here in Atlanta is Trish McCannon, who you probably have heard of. She wrote a book on Jesus's earlier years before his ministry, and one of those in the book she wrote, the she details how he went through the Egyptian mystery schools, as well as studied with the Druids and in India. So those three areas of study were necessary for Jesus before he was able to become the master that is detailed in the Bible. So, even Jesus was not able to do it automatically. He had to do the work as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know, that Jesus came from Galilee. And although we always think now these days of Galilee being an area which was essentially Hebrew and therefore Jewish at the time of Jesus, it was a hotbed of other religions as well. They were coming in from all over the Roman Empire. In particular, the cult of Isis was extremely strong in that region, and also of Demeter. There are many people who believe, and I believe, that Mary Magdalene, who was mentioned in the Gospels, was probably extremely important in this as well, and that Jesus and Mary Magdalene may in fact have been man and wife, and that could have been where the bloodline comes from.
Yeah, there's historically there seems to be three children, but the bloodline only came through the youngest son because the other two didn't have children. The information that I have is that after the crucifixion, the family of Christ, including Mary, Joseph, Mary Magdalene, and the children were in danger. So they traveled to France, and in fact, Jesus went with them because he actually did not die on the cross. He was because he was master of these things. He was given something that made him appear dead, but then he was able to be resuscitated. So he went with them to France. It was too dangerous in France for him to stay there, however. And he made his way to India, where he remained until he died at a very old age. He is reported to have written things in India, but nothing survived. I was interested in your book to see that there were evidence of some writings of Jesus. Would you like to expand on those? Because that's very interesting. I was in Bible school at one time, and I asked my teacher why nothing Jesus ever wrote made it into the Bible, and of course there was no answer to that.
I don't recall us mentioning anything specific of that kind in the book, but it is something that I've come across myself. Uh-huh. In the Vedic tradition in India, there are people who are quite sure that a teacher came from that region and about that time. And there are, in Vedic traditions, quite a lot of things which bear a great similarity to the kind of stories we find in the parables that have found their way into the Bible. The idea right. that Jesus survived the crucifixion is one that's been with me through most of my life. It just seems the most likely explanation. As to whether Jesus came to France, I'm not absolutely certain about that, though I know a lot of people think he did. There are also strong traditions, you know, that he came to England and particularly to a place called Glastonbury, probably in the company of Joseph of Arimathea.
He was younger then. That was before his ministry. According to Tricia, Joseph was the main supplier to the Roman army of 10. And that's why he went to England frequently, and he took Jesus would have been a teenager with him. And there was an awful lot of history in Trisha's book about what happened in England. And at one time, I believe Jesus was about eight years old. This was an earlier trip. Jesus was about 8 years old, and this happened in Ireland. And Jesus got mad at somebody. And then the boy fell dead, and there are stories in Ireland about the local people admonishing Joseph for this happening, and then I think the family decided to enroll Jesus in, you know, some training so that his temper would not have, you know, because if you have these kind of powers and you don't control your emotions, obviously, when you lash out energetically, you can have some very negative effects on people if you can't control it. So according to Trish, this was part of the story that got him enrolled in some schools that would help him with emotional maturity. Which would be important if you had that kind of power, you know.
Yeah, when you look at the when you look at the parables, when you look at the things that Jesus actually said, and although the Bible has been quite dramatically changed since, when you look at the sentences that quite definitely seem to have come from him, then there does appear to be elements of other belief patterns in there. So although he was most certainly a Jewish rabbi, he was bringing other facts to bear from the mystery religions and who knows, even from Druidism. It's really impossible to say, because the area where all this happened in Galilee, it was just a melting pot. So
yeah, there was a lot. The Zeolites, there were a lot of different organizations at that time.
Yeah. And we know so little about those 30 years before find Jesus appearing in the religious and historical record, that the stories that Trish tells could just as easily be true.
Yeah, one thing that helps tie everything together, too, is the fact that Mary, his mother, was brought to his grandmother was from England or Ireland, I can't remember which one. She was beaten by her husband. Her husband died, and she inherited all his wealth. And she took Mary to an Essene village, you know, or order, because the Essenes were very much, I guess, New Age principles. They were vegetarians. They did healings. They believed in reincarnation. They were a Jewish sect, but they were very, very evolved for their time. And that's where Mary was actually raised. And it was probably the Essenes that figured out that she was supposed to marry and figure out who she was supposed to marry, Joseph, who was way older than her. He was over 40, and I think she was 13. And so he went on. Joseph left for about 6 months because he wasn't going to have sex with her. And then when he came back, she was pregnant. So that's a little bit of that story, which is interesting.
The Essene connection, the Essene connection is fascinating, because the Essenes lived in many places, but they had one particular place called Qumran, which was in the Jordan Valley, which was in operation at the time when Jesus himself was alive. And there are a lot of experts who say that many of the things that Jesus put forward, many of his ideas, were very like Essene ideas. So it's quite likely that during his own lifetime, Jesus had already perhaps spent some time with them.
Yeah, so there's a lot of very, very interesting things that have been covered up deliberately, because the agenda to be put forth by the Catholic Church is typically that, you know, the people don't really need to read anything. They just need to listen to the, you know, the priests and the hierarchy within the church, and that they just need to give 10% of what they earn to the church, and the church will take care of everything else. You know, it's kind of like just keep people kind of uneducated and on a kind of a narrow path there, and then the church will assure their salvation.
Yeah, they're having a bit of a problem with that at the moment, because people are becoming more educated, asking more questions. And then there are the situations regarding the alternative gospels, some of which turned up in the 1940s in Nag Hammadi in Egypt, which tell the Jesus story in a significantly different way in some ways, and in which Mary Magdalene in particular is much more important. The thing about the established New Testament of the Bible is that the Christian Church, and particularly Catholicism, had several hundred years to make it say ultimately what they wanted it to say. And you're quite right. The whole idea was that you listened to what the priest said, you didn't read it yourself, and you just accepted it. But it's not like that these days.
Yeah, and then again, emphasizing why the Templars had the power they did. They not only had the knowledge, but according to your book, actually may have taken the bones from the burial site of Jesus's family. Would you like to talk about that for a minute? They might have had the physical evidence that what we were talking about was true.
Yes.
Which would, you know, of course, physical evidence is what the Catholic Church doesn't want to have come forth.
Oh, absolutely not. Not so far from Jerusalem, going back some years now, there was some building work going on, and some explosives were used. And they opened up the front of what had been a burial place, a grave, of a fairly typical sort of the period of Jesus. And this wasn't at all unusual, and still isn't all that unusual in Israel. These things happen. So they brought in some rescue archaeologists, and they discovered that the ossuaries, now ossuaries are like a bit like very small coffins, if you like, because what they used to do was there would be a forecourt to a tomb. The bodies would be laid out in the forecourt until they defleshed and just became bones. And then the bones would be placed into these ossuaries and placed inside the tomb. In this particular tomb, they found a whole series with names on, names that statistically could only really be associated with the story of Jesus, because his brothers were mentioned, his mother was mentioned, his father was mentioned. And it was almost certainly the case that they were looking at the family of Jesus. And one of these was called Miriam, which was the proper name of Mary Magdalene. When the ossuaries were found, they were empty, but there were indications that somebody had been in the tomb at a much earlier date. And what seems very likely is that while the Templars were in Jerusalem, they had visited this tomb and that they had taken some of the bones, specifically those of Mary Magdalene, and that they may have found their way ultimately to what is now the United States.
Yeah, so where do you think, well, let's talk a little bit about the evidence that the Templars came to the United States years, many, many years before Christopher Columbus did, and that actually when Christopher Columbus came over, he probably came over armed with maps and all sorts of knowledge about where he was going, and then why the Templars needed to hide these things in the America. Why that was necessary.
Yeah. The fact that the Templars went to America before Columbus is attestified by a whole series of archaeological finds in the United States itself. There are quite a significant number of rune stones, for example, which tend to show that visitors were there and that they were probably Templars going back to probably 1300 or maybe even earlier than that. This wouldn't be at all surprising. One of the things that always puzzles me is this whole idea that Christopher Columbus was the first European to go to America. In the United Kingdom, where I live, down on the southwest, is a city called Bristol. And out in Bristol, traditions associated with this huge continent out in the Atlantic go back many hundreds of years and long before Columbus. And even fishermen from Bristol used to know about the Grand Banks off Canada, and they also knew about the United States. Now, in their time, the Templars were the best sailors in the world. None were better, and they were always looking for new trading contacts. So I think it would be extremely unlikely, irrespective of anything else that we've talked about, that they were not going there. Even though we're now well into the modern era with the Templars, there were certain commodities that they still needed. Bronze was still used for an awful lot of things. They needed copper. They needed tin. They came regularly to Britain. They had quite a few headquarters in Britain and also in Ireland. And the reason that they wanted to go to the United States, Janet and I are really sure, is because they wanted to create what they would have called the New Jerusalem. They knew that that the old countries of Europe were corrupt. They knew that they couldn't get the kind of democracy, the kind of personal freedom, the kind of equality of the sexes that they wanted going in Europe. They knew about America because they'd travelled so extensively, and it must have seemed logical to them that if they couldn't set up what they wanted in Europe, and there was nowhere where they could do that, then North America would be the place to go. They knew pretty much from earlier people, the Vikings in particular, where they were going to, and they had a lot of Viking sailors. So it wasn't at all extraordinary that they ended up in North America.
And we know that they had fleets of ships that mysteriously disappeared because I think Philip was unable to capture them, right? He went to do that, and then they were gone.
Yeah, I mean, not only most of the Templars in France itself had disappeared on that day when he went to try and capture them all, but the headquarters for the Templar Navy was in a place called La Rochelle, and the boats in La Rochelle, the ships in La Rochelle, had sailed one or two days before Philip moved against the Templars. Nobody knows where they went. Almost certainly some of them went to the west coast of Scotland. Others may well have gone to North America.
So just to remind the audience, the Templars were now an illegal organization, but a highly secretive and highly organized and highly wealthy organization. So that's why they're not in the history books, period, because they couldn't be.
Yes. I mean, they are in the history books in the sense that Orthodox normal historians will say the Templars did exist, but they show the Templars starting on a particular date, and they say the Templars finished in 1307. That's absolute nonsense.
Right. And then, so linking this back to our founding fathers and our Declaration of Independence, and then even the outlay of Washington, D.C., which is what the book is your book goes on to show the links of. Let's go back to how the Templars probably influenced, and then I guess really via the Freemasons, which became an outgrowth of the Templars, how this really shaped our early history, and how probably the American Revolution probably should have never been successful, except that it took advantage of certain principles that were very much coming out of the Templars and out of the mystery schools.
Yes, yeah, that's very true. We have to remember that the people involved, the ones that Janet and I call the Venus families, they're the operators. And so organizations like the Templars are working at their behest, really. There are Venus family members in the Templars, but they're doing, the Templars are doing what they are told. And they're part of an organization that goes back a very, very, very long time. We know, for example, that a system of measurement was used in the building of Washington, D.C., which was known right back as early as 3500 B.C., in the west of Europe. There are many, many truly ancient traditions. And, of course, we're going back to a time where there was no specific god who stood alone, as became the norm later. That really didn't happen until much later. But when structures like Stonehenge were being built, the goddess was very much more important. There was much more of a balance in religion. And the one thing we found out about these Venus families is that they kept this balance. This is something they passed on generation after generation. And we find, for example, as I said, with the Lost Gospels, that Jesus shows those tendencies as well, even though they've been eradicated from the standard Gospels. So they had a great deal of influence, but they had to keep it very quiet because the Catholic Church was extremely powerful. But they took all this ancient knowledge, they managed to maneuver the fighting of the First Crusade so that they could get into Jerusalem. They took what they needed from Jerusalem, and ultimately they took it to America. But the same principles that they had espoused all along, partly via Freemasonry, for example, became really important in the founding of the United States. But they couldn't do what they wanted to do while ever Britain was still in charge of the colonies there. So, as you just said, using the principles of democracy and freedom and fairness, they were able to persuade the American colonists to fight against the British and ultimately to win. I mean, it was utterly incredible what happened. It was the most exciting adventure in democracy that the world had ever seen until that time.
Mm-hmm. And probably without the help of the French, it would have never happened, which is ironic.
It is quite ironic, but I think we have to bear in mind what was going on politically at that time. The French were French people were fed up with the monarchy because, well, for the same reason the Templars left in the end, because everything was so utterly corrupt. And so the French were having a revolution of their own, and it suited them to back the Americans with their revolution. But it came at just the right time. But it is utterly ironic, really.
So there is evidence that Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and other founding fathers were Freemasons. And we know that they were more spiritually educated because of this and used those principles in the founding of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and as well as how things were set up with the states. And it's interesting to me, the states, retaining states' rights, there is kind of a correlation there. Between the how the federal government relates to the states, and then say how the national organization of the Freemasons relates to the lodges, or even the national grange relates to the individual, local granges. Go ahead and tell the listening audience about the granges. Because I had no idea that existed.
That was amazing. We get this happening all the time with the Venus families. If we go, just as one example, if we go back to the founding of the Templars, they worked in that way, but they came out of an earlier group of monks called the Cistercians. And it's in the Cistercians that we find the real principles upon which everything else was ultimately built. If you were a Cistercian monk, you were just as important as every other monk. And all the Cistercian monks in a particular abbey would come together, and they would choose who was going to be the next abbot, the guy in charge of the abbey. And every year, the abbots from all of the Cistercian monasteries would go to Citeaux in France, which was the headquarters of the order, and they would choose who was going to be the abbot of the whole order. So from first to last, we have democracy working. And the Venus families did this so many times. They did it with the Templars. It's the same in Freemasonry. But it's particularly evident, as you said, in the Grange Order of Farming, Husbandry, which was founded in America just after the American Civil War and was founded upon probably the most democratic principles that were ever seen in the world up until that point in time, mainly because it included women. So the Grange was groups of people who came together in local communities. The reason for them existing was to lobby both state and federal organizations to get better deals for farmers. But they also existed at a state level, and a representative was chosen at a local level to go to state level. And then once again, just like the Cistercians, state level voted to send someone to Washington, D.C. So the principles upon which the Grange worked were exactly the same as those upon which the Cistercians worked. And even the name is significant because the Cistercian monks were farmers predominantly. They had outlying farms, which no other monastic institution had done before. And these farms were called granges. And that's where the word grange came from, that the Grange Order of Husbandry chose.
And this was so amazing because it was many, many years. I mean, the suffrage movement didn't even begin until the, around 1910 or so.
Yeah,
I mean, way before that.
Yeah, it was a good 50 or 60 years before female suffrage came in, either in the United States or over here in Europe. But in the Grange, women had absolute equality. And what's more, the Grange had rituals which were very much like Freemasonic rituals, but all of the Grange rituals were supervised by women carrying the names of ancient goddesses. So if anything, they had more influence in the Grange than men did. And it was the women in the Grange who were the cement that held the whole thing together. And as you said, 50, 60 years before they even got the vote.
Well, the spiritual principle here is that if you don't honor duality, and if you go too far to one side or the other, and probably modern Western history has gone too far into the masculine and not represented the feminine, if you lose that balance, then that's a recipe for disaster.
And
we almost got into a nuclear war a number of times based on stupid stuff. You know, it was probably just the divine guidance of a few high silo people and military leaders that made it so we didn't destroy the earth already with nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
I mean, if you read the history of what almost happened a couple of times, especially around 2000 in Russia.
Yeah,
they had an incident there.
My take on how this came about is that when we were hunter-gatherers, women were probably more important than men in a tribal sense, because although men used to go out hunting, they only provided on average, and still do hunter-gatherers, about 25% of the food that comes into the tribe, whereas the women were the really knowledgeable ones. They were the gatherers. They provided more food. And so if there was a balance, it tended to swing in favor of women. And in the mystery religions in particular, the earth was seen as being female because the earth gives birth to everything that we need in order to live. But once farming came along, the situation changed quite significantly, because men then could feel, because they had greater physical strength, that they were in charge of everything that was going on. And so I think it's likely that it was at that time that women were marginalized, and when the paternalistic religions such as Judaism, ultimately Christianity, came along, because before that the whole situation had been much more balanced, and that was one of the things I'm sure that they were trying to put right.
Well, it is a spiritual principle that, and Buddha said this, Buddha says the way to enlightenment is the middle road. It's between the two dualities. I mean, you don't get very far going out so far you fall off the edge, which is what happens, you know, if you're not balanced. So
I think the middle road is the
way to enlightenment, period.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, because I think it's quite possible to go too far in the opposite direction as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And we find, particularly in the structures that have been built in Washington, D.C., a recognition of that balance. The Washington Monument, for example, is like a huge sundial, and it's been built specifically so that the shadow, the point of the shadow from the monument, goes to certain structures on the Mall in Washington, D.C. at certain times of year. And on the 21st of December, which is the midwinter solstice, which has always been important to so-called pagan religions, The sun is very low in the sky and it pushes the shadow of the monument so that the tip of the monument just cuts inside a part just south of the White House, which is known as the ellipse. And if we take the ellipse as representing, if you like, the egg of the Earth, then the sun's power through the Washington Monument and through the shadow, if you like, inseminates that egg. But it takes both. It takes the sky and it takes the Earth, and that's where the duality is and where the balance is.
Yeah, that's very true. There's been a number of books and popular movies that have emphasized these kind of relationships and even hinted toward the fact that Jesus was married and had a family. Do you think these have had any impact on the population?
Yeah, no doubt about it. When I first came across these ideas 20, 30 years ago, very few people knew anything about them. I think the proliferation of the kind of films you're talking about, and especially a lot of documentary television, and now, of course, the internet, spreads these things more and more, and people find these ideas much more credible than they once did. Also, going back to something that we mentioned very early in this conversation, people used to be a lot more frightened than they are now. I mean, it's not so many generations ago when if you came up with any of these ideas, you could have been imprisoned or even burned at the stake. But the very democracy, the very free thinking, which allowed a country like the United States to come into existence, also breeds education, and superstition goes out of the window and people can find things out for themselves. The established organizations like the church don't like it, but there's no longer anything much they can do about it.
Well, we're coming up in a few minutes on the end of the interview. Would you like to give your contact information for the audience?
Yes. If anybody wants to know more about the book that Janet, Walter and I wrote, if they go to www.nationofthegoddess.com, it's all one word, nationofthegoddess.com, then they'll find a great deal there. And that will tell them, if they want to buy the book, how they can go about buying it. It's available in all good bookshops. It's available on Amazon. And they'll also learn something about the other books that I've written. And we're starting to put information on about television documentaries that we've appeared in and some of the talks that we've given. I was across in the United States a couple of weeks ago with Janet. We traveled all around New England, talked to loads of people, and these ideas are just gaining more and more ground as time goes on.
Yeah, I was guided many years ago to read a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the ideas in that book were, I guess, instilled in me very deeply, that it is truly a bloodline that we're talking about, a bloodline that probably began with the house of David, went through Solomon, went through Jesus, and then continued down through the Moldavian kings.
Yes.
Who were descendants. And I found it very interesting in your book. You said that they were more like gods, and they delegated the day-to-day stuff to their mayors. You want to talk about that for a minute? That was very interesting.
Yeah, this group of kings called the Merovingians, they believed themselves to be descended from a lost tribe of Israel. And actually, when you trace it back historically, although we don't have time to talk about it too much, it looks like it could have been the case. And the kings, they didn't really want anything to do with the material side of life. They represented figureheads. And although they were Christians, the early ones in particular, we'd have called very strange Christians. So the bloodline ran through the Merovingians.
And then that bloodline went over to England and was prominent in the Tudor court, and then came to America. And much of what's in your book is information from that bloodline in the U.S. And again, Freemasonry is and the Scottish Rite and all the other organizations came out of that bloodline. So it's so interesting where all these secret societies and the structures that then made the states versus the federal government, they do all line up. It's the principles actually come out of the mystery schools. And that is so interesting.
Yeah, and just as you see the bloodline, you can see the development of the people we call the Venus families, and we call them that because we want to give them one collective name, but you find them appearing as the Cistercians, as the Templars. When the Templars go, then it's Freemasonry, the Grange. So, yes, they're all related.
That's wonderful. Well, I think that if you look at the history of the United States and what it was meant to be, I'm not sure that we're that today in all aspects. I think we have another revolution coming that will free us up from the military-industrial complex, hopefully. But in any case, it makes sense that we were born out of these mystery schools because this had to have influences that were pretty secretive and powerful to have this happen, especially breaking away from organized religion, breaking away from the monarchy system, and breaking away from other institutions that would not allow the freedoms that we have.
Absolutely, and at the end of the day, it isn't merely going forward in time, it's going a great deal of the distance back in time. So it's a reappraisal of things from ancient history rather than something which is unique to us. All these people have been trying to do is to reestablish the kind of duality that you've been talking about.
Right, right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we've been interviewing Alan Butler, who is the co-author, along with Janet Wolter, of American Nation of the Goddess, The Venus Families and the Founding of the United States. I am very pleased to have this book on this show because I really believe that the ancient mysteries are incredibly important to understand and to bring into to correct the disbalance that we have right now in the Western world. We're not done yet. We have another revolution, another correction coming up that will be very, very important. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.